this will be important, also from a listening character.
Thank you very much. DDG, if you can introduce yourself and the team.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Good morning to you and to the Honourable Members. I'm Thomas Osterhuis, Deputy Director General in the Department of Science and Technology. I'm going to ask my colleagues to introduce themselves as well.
Good morning. My name is Thomas and I'm also from the Department of Science and Technology.
Good morning. My name is
Good morning, my name is Sumit Kangro from the Department of Science and Technology. Thank you very much. We know that sometimes you might forget who this person is, but the informatory part has been helpful. You are all welcome. We are here today so that we can get an update from the department with regards to the legislative processes around the indigenous knowledge systems. And we will allow the DDG to take us through, and then we will interact with the process once the implementation has been done. Over to you, DDG.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. First of all, just to extend has said Mr. Sukhanandan, Ms. Adek, and Ms. Pango are from our IKS division. Ms. January at the end there is from our legal section, so that you have a sense of where they are. Secondly, Honourable Chair, if you'll allow me, you may recall that in August last year we made a presentation to the committee on Indigenous Knowledge System, on our Indigenous Knowledge Systems program. And with your permission, I'd like to just hand out hard copies of it again, just as background information for the Honourable Members to look at in their own time. As you correctly said, Honourable Chair, today we will be briefing you on the bill for the protection and development management and protection of Indigenous knowledge, not on IKS more broadly. That was the purpose of last year's presentation. I'm going to ask Mr. Sukhanandan and Ms. Vanek to take us through the presentation, if I may.
Thank you, DDG. Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members of the Committee, perhaps I suppose. Perhaps I should also thank you for allowing us this opportunity to brief you on the process thus far. Chief, this is an important process for us in that we will be approaching Cabinet in the near future to adopt the IKS bill. The process or the finalization of this bill will be unparalleled in the world. Okay, this will be the first instrument that will protect Indigenous knowledge systems. In saying that, Chair, our presentation will traverse the historical background, will provide some rationale
just for clarity, you're saying that we are protecting Indigenous knowledge, we are using systems to protect Indigenous knowledge, so this is not about the Indigenous knowledge system, it is about the Indigenous knowledge or the Indigenous knowledge system.
It is about the Indigenous knowledge.
It's a system that will protect Indigenous knowledge.
Yes. We will provide a very brief description of the process pro and post drafting. We will present the substantive clauses and also the process thereafter. Chair, in terms of the precursor to the development of the bill was the adoption of the Indigenous Knowledge Systems Policy in 2004. And perhaps it would be another 2 moments for me just to walk you back through the historical process in terms of the development of policy. In 1998, the former Portfolio Committee of Our Culture, Science and Technology presented Canada with a five-member bill on the protection of Indigenous and non-Indigenous. Cabinet recommended that the portfolio present a more comprehensive bill in terms of the protection of IK. That process was then mandated to the former Department of Arts, Culture, Science and Technology to proceed with the process of developing a policy and a legislation. The Human Science Research Council was then commissioned to proceed with that process. In 2001, a draft policy and a bill was presented to the department. The department, in its wisdom, decided to get, because of the complex nature of Indigenous knowledge, the department decided to have an independent opinion. A review team was then assembled to assess the complexity of the policy and the legislation. The department then invited both the drafting team and the review team to have a look at the recommendations of the review team. And in 2004, Cabinet adopted the IKS policy. Thereafter, the IKS policy had a number of imperatives, and one of the imperatives of the IKS policy was the establishment of a national office. And in 2005, the office was established under the ambit of the Department of Science and Technology. Within the policy, a very important imperative was in Chapter 6. In Chapter 6, it recommended the development of an IKS legislation. And it is within this mandate that the Department of Science and Technology proceeds with the development of a legislation. The bill was collectively developed by an internal task team comprising of our legal unit, our national property management office, and officials from the National Indigenous Assistance Office. During the drafting process, there was a collective diagnosis of South Africa's obligation, international obligations in terms of its protocols and its declarations that South Africa are signatories to. Secondly, there was a rapid synthesis of all the current legislation that impact on Indigenous knowledge. And given the maturity of the text, on the 27th of March 2013, the DSC senior executive approved the bill for consultation among its national government departments. Letters were sent to the Director Generals of those government departments that were part of the Interdepartmental Committee on IKS, and there are 15 departments which are represented on the Interdepartmental Committee. A number of bilateral meetings and roundtable sessions were held. Emerging out of these consultation meetings, there were very compelling recommendations, and importantly, there was a overwhelming support of the legislation. In view of the maturity of the legislation, the department then decided to subject the bill to an independent review. The mandate or the remit of the review was to see whether the bill was in public interest, whether the bill complies with South Africa's international obligations, and lastly, whether the bill was coherent and logical. After the review of the bill, the bill was approved by Cabinet on the 20th of February, it was approved on the 12th of February, and it was published in the Government Gazette on the 20th of February. The closing date for the comment period was on the 30th of May. During the comment period, we received 29 written submissions, and we had 13 different meetings in the 9 provinces. Chair, the question then would would arise while in education on indigenous knowledge systems. Currently, within the international landscape, there are two systems of two models of protection. The first model provides for explicit idea of protection, and examples of such a system is the UNESCO model law and the Chinese model law. And then you have an alternative system which provides, nonetheless, which provides IP protection. And this is where the IKS legislation sits. It's within an alternate system of protection. In drafting the bill, Chair, the doctors took into account two very important frameworks. The first one was the Nagoya Protocol. The Nagoya Protocol was ratified by South Africa in 2013 and came in effect in 2014. In September 2014, the drafters looked at Article 6, 7, and 12 of the Nagoya Protocol, which relates directly to the protection of indigenous knowledge. Furthermore, the drafters took into consideration the provisions of the text, which is currently negotiated at the World Intellectual Property Organization, and within the WIPO platform, we have three texts which are being negotiated: a text on traditional knowledge, a text on traditional cultural affairs, and a text on genetic resources associated with traditional knowledge. And the drafters, when they go through the substantive clauses of the text, you would notice that there are mirror images of the text that's been currently negotiated at the World Intellectual Property Rights Organization. Chair, you would know that in 2013 a legislation was passed for the protection of indigenous knowledge from an economic perspective, and this legislation was driven by the DTI. So I'm just going to very briefly mention the differences between the IP Amendment Act and the IKS bill. The IKS bill has a very broad scope in that it caters for three types of protection. It caters for defensive protection, it caters for positive protection, and it caters for preservation. So in terms of defensive protection, it is preventing a third party from exercising any IP rights. That's defensive protection. Positive protection is authorizing the use of the IP right, whereas the IP Amendment Act only provides for positive rights, which is authorizing the use of any IP right. Secondly, the IP Amendment Act only provides rights for third parties. It does not provide any rights for communities per se. So the IKS bill provides rights for communities. Thirdly, the IP Amendment Act provides economic incentives for indigenous knowledge that resides within its database. And that indigenous knowledge which is in its database is in the public domain. Whereas the IKS bill provides protection for both knowledge which is in the public domain and knowledge which is confidential. Fourthly, the IP Amendment Act reduces all knowledge into its material form. And given that 80% of all indigenous knowledge is still in the oral phase, so the IKS bill makes provision for the protection of knowledge which is still in the oral phase. Firstly, the IKS bill makes provision for trans-border protection of IKS. And lastly, the period of protection in terms of the IKS Amendment Act is limited and corporate life and 50 years thereafter. Whereas the IDS bill has protection as long as the eligibility criteria are satisfied. So coming back to the substantive issues of the bill, the main title of the bill today is the Protection, Promotion, Development and Management of Indigenous Knowledge System, and provides for the establishment of a national office with the function of management of rights, establishment of an advisory committee, access and conditions of access, registration, accreditation, and the development of ICS-based innovation. In terms of Section 1 deals with the definitions that's embedded within the text. And in Section 1, there are 37 definitions. As I indicated that we looked at two very important international protocols, the Nagoya Protocol and the World Intellectual Property Rights. The drafters adapted the definitions from these two protocols and embedded them in the text. The Section 2 of the bill deals with interpretation. In terms of this section, the courts, when the courts interpret the provisions of the Act, it must take into consideration customary law, but also take into consideration South Africa's obligation and international law. Section 3 deals with the application of the Act. The default position here, Jay, is the Constitution. When the Act applies to all South Africans in relationship to Indigenous knowledge, it recognizes the knowledge prior to the Act coming into force, and it recognizes knowledge. And it recognizes all knowledge after the Act. It's important, Chair, to use the purpose of the bill. The purpose of the bill is the protection of indigenous knowledge from misappropriation and illicit use. Secondly, it acknowledges prior art in the examination of novelty and inventiveness of patents granted on the basis of indigenous knowledge. Thirdly, it promotes public awareness and the understanding of IAK and its wider application. Fourthly, it promotes strengthening and development of the potential of indigenous communities. Fifth, it promotes the commercial utilization of the knowledge, and also creates legal recognition for the cataloging and documentation of indigenous knowledge. And lastly, it establishes an accreditation and certification mechanism. In terms of Section 5, the Act establishes a National Indigenous Knowledge Systems Office, which is a non-juristic entity under the Department of Science and Technology. The function of the office is to protect and restore the recognition of indigenous knowledge, facilitate redress of communities of benefits that they were previously deprived in terms of recognition and economic benefits, facilitate and coordinate the development of innovation, manage the national record system, and mobilize indigenous communities through public awareness and education programs. In terms of the administration of it, so the minister must appoint the head of the ISO. And in appointing, the process has to be transparent and competitive. The head of the ISO will be responsible for the management and the day-to-day function of ISO. And the head of ISO will report to the minister. And in terms of the staff, the minister may employ staff in accordance with the Public Service Act. In terms of the establishment of an advisory committee, the minister may establish an advisory committee consisting of not more than 10 members. And the role of the advisory panel is to provide expert and strategic advice doing so. They have indicated that in our negotiation on three tests at World Intellectual Property Rights, the subject matter of these three tests has been transplanted within Section 10. So Section 10 essentially is a mirror image of what's been negotiated at the World Intellectual Property Rights, and these are the three areas: it's indigenous knowledge, indigenous cultural expression, and indigenous knowledge associated with cultural and genetic resources. Examples of the first bullet is your technical innovation. The second one is more your literary and your artistic, and the third one is your knowledge about traditional medicines. In terms of the eligibility criteria, this all as well is the replica of the discussions that have been held at the World Intellectual Property Rights Organization. Given that internationally there is no definition of what is indigenous knowledge, so in terms of the negotiation criteria have been affixed to what constitutes the knowledge. And the criteria are passed from generation to generation. It is the result of creative activity and is associated with the social identity of a particular community, and it has to be maintained, used, and developed. In terms of scope, the beneficiaries will have exclusive rights in terms of enjoying control and utilizing the resources. They would have an opportunity to authorize and deny access to the resource, prevent misappropriation, prevent the use of the resource without prior informed consent, and ensure that the use of the resource is done within cultural norms and practices. And lastly, within the scope of the Act, any IPR must meet disclosure requirements, and there are four disclosure requirements. One of the before disclosure requirement is the disclosure of the knowledge, disclosure of the genetic origin of the geographical origin of the knowledge, evidence of prior informed consent, and evidence of benefit sharing. In terms of the protection, the knowledge will be protected as long as that knowledge satisfies the eligibility criteria. And if you look back at the eligibility criteria, the fourth criteria is the most important, is that the knowledge has been maintained, used, and developed. If that knowledge does not satisfy the fourth criteria, then the protection will then be transposed under the Heritage Act. And in terms of the beneficiaries, the beneficiaries are any individuals or individuals, families who are recognized by the community to whom custody or protection of the knowledge is entrusted. So this is a very important aspect that it now moves away from the collective nature to entrusting that collective part of that knowledge to a particular trustee. Okay. And in terms of state ownership, the state has no ownership of the knowledge. It only has a custodian role in terms of when a beneficiary has not been identified. Chair, I will now hand over to my colleague to take you through the next three articles.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. I will take you through the accreditation section. Going back to where my colleague Tom started about the background of the IGF policy, the accreditation also stems from there where it requested the Department of Science and Technology and Education Department to explore existing opportunities within the national qualification framework towards the accreditation and certification of IGF holders and practitioners in the country. So basically the purpose of this system is to provide the system to recognize, to standardize, to professionalize indigenous holders and practitioners, their skills, their experiences, their learning and practices. We at the Department of Science and Technology have been working with various government departments, of which the Department of Health is part of it, concerns stakeholders such as ICAS practitioners and the collective qualifications for quality in developing a model towards that we look at how do we create norms and standards towards the competencies towards the qualification of ICAS practitioners and holders. So basically this system affirms indigenous knowledge as a knowledge domain in its own, on its own merit. It will recognize institutions, the governance structures, the approaches to quality assurance, the rules and practices that are inherent in the systems. And as I said, we have currently developed a draft regulatory framework for the accreditation and certification in collaboration with various government departments, which provides the foundation of the system within the national qualification framework. Section 16 are looking at, it basically describes how the application would happen in terms of how any community of practice may apply to NICSO, the National ICAS Office, which the body is looking at established, to accredit or an agent or to certify indigenous knowledge practitioners competencies or admission in a register of designations. But basically prescribes what needs to be done in terms of procedure towards accreditation. Whereas Section 17 talks about the role of the National ICAS Office towards development of the system, where it basically defines that the certification and the accreditation procedures is to happen in the alignment of the National Qualification System in consultation with the South African Qualification Authority, as well as how we develop norms and standards for the accreditation of indigenous knowledge, and how that norms and standards would be revised from time to time. I need to stress that this accreditation system looks at the qualification of and the competencies for IA practitioners. For instance, if I'm talking about practitioners, whether they are in the healing system, whether they are in the farming system, whether they are in the accreditation system. Currently, there is no norm standards that exist in the country, and this accreditation system is looking at the qualification thereof. The difference between what the department is looking at and the Department of Health is looking at, health is basically looking at the practice in terms of quality assurance of the cleanliness, how the practice should operate and so forth. So the qualification basically supports what the Department of Health is doing. The next section looks at the documentation and the recording of indigenous knowledge in the country. Honourable members, please note that if you don't know your knowledge holder, you will know what to protect. And the basis of the bill is about the protection, the promotion, the development and the management of indigenous knowledge in South Africa. So this section mainly looks at how do we build the research infrastructure for indigenous knowledge to enable the protection, promotion, development and management in South Africa. It basically looks at the creation of a documentation system, which we term the National Recording System, which is documenting and recording oral indigenous knowledge systems in partnership with communities. So this system, so this section talks about the creation of such a system, and that the minister may provide conditions for storage, access, transmission, management and security of the documented and recorded indigenous knowledge. I need to say as well as that we started with the implementation of such a system through IGS documentation centers that are established at a provincial level. It's currently established in 7 provinces, of which KwaZulu-Natal, North West Province, Western Cape, Free State, Limpopo Province, Eastern Cape Province, as well as Eastern Cape Province. We have established and going ahead, the next 2 provinces will be Mpumalanga and Gauteng. So basically those are the platforms that facilitate the documentation and the recording of IK in partnership with communities. With that, I'll give over to my colleague Tom to talk through the next section.
In terms of Section 19 deals with the coordination of bioprospecting activity. Chair, the Department of Science and Technology, we have already given effect to this session is that we have already created a viable second platform which straddles African traditional medicines, cosmeceuticals, nutraceuticals, and herbal teas. So in terms of G19, we are quite comfortable that this this section is well established within the Department of Science and Technology. In terms of section 20, perhaps we view it as one of the most important sections of the Act. It deals with the issues of access. So in terms of anyone that was accessing IKEA must apply to NIFSO for consent. And when NIFSO considers any consent, it will do so in consultation with that affected order and community. But more importantly, if any person that agreed with the decision or the conditions of access may within 60 days apply to a court of law, appeal that condition and decision in a court of law. In terms of section 21, 21 deals with the issues of benefit sharing. Any third party wishing to access business knowledge must enter into a benefit sharing agreement, whether it's for commercial or industrial application. The third party and the community must enter into a benefit sharing agreement, and the terms of the benefit sharing agreement must ensure due rewards and guarantee fair and equitable benefits. One of the functions of NIFSO is to assist communities in concluding these benefit sharing agreements. In terms of the mediation committee, the national office must constitute a mediation committee, and in resolving the prime or the main function of the mediation committee is to ensure or is to resolve issues of ownership, and when the committee is resolving issues of ownership, it must take into consideration customary law. In terms of section 23 regarding transport arrangement, this article is in compliance with South Africa ratification of the Nagoya Protocol. So in terms of transport arrangement, any knowledge which originates in a foreign jurisdiction will have the same protection as though that knowledge resides within the Republic, provided that there is a reciprocal agreement. In terms of legal jargon, this would mean national treatment. In terms of exceptions and limitations, no prior informed consent is required in instances such as teaching, academic purposes, events of natural disasters and emergency. So when a user makes use of the knowledge, he has to acknowledge the source, he has to acknowledge the geographical origin of the material. So in terms of section 25 deals with the various deals with the various issues of offences, and the three most important issues around offences is that when a user makes a non-customary use of the knowledge, when he acts or makes an omission which is inconsistent with the moral rights of the community, and if he's not a registered holder and he enters into a commercial agreement to the exclusion of the community, this would constitute an offence. In terms of the penalties, there are a whole stream of penalties which includes written fines, written warnings, fines, confiscation and embargoes of the activity. In terms of the section 27 and 28 and 29 chair are just standard provisions in a legislation. And lastly, chair, in terms of the title, the actual report, the protection, promotion, development and management of indigenous non-existence. With that, chair, I thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and the Honourable Members, for your questions and comments and observations. I'll pick up on the first question by the Honourable Honoff around costs and link that to a response also to the Honourable Portman on structural issues. And then my colleagues, both from the IKS section as well as possibly Ms. January from our legal section, will provide responses on the other more detailed legal technical issues that were raised. So first of all, on the question of cost and structure, within the Department of Science and Technology, there exists a National Indigenous Knowledge Systems Office. So this office has already been established in the form of
shall we say, the director in the department. And this office was established subsequent to the policy being approved by Cabinet in 2004. But the office has never had its own act established to govern what the office should do. And we have gotten to a point, honourable members, where we have developed indigenous knowledge systems that promote and protect indigenous knowledge to the point where we need to structure it really. And that's really the background to the act, but we need an act to establish NICSO formally with its own authority and rules and procedures. So to a large extent, honourable members, the structure is already in existence in the department, is already funded in the department. We are now engaging with the Treasury, specifically the technical advisory section of Treasury, to identify the best type of structure that NICSO should have, because one option would be to establish NICSO as a separate juristic body with its own act, like the National Research Foundation or the CSIR. There are considerable costs involved in doing that, because all such bodies have their own boards. That's a lot of costs associated with the boards. They all have to have their own administrative section, HR, finance, governance, risk management, all of that. Those are all significant overhead. At the moment, all of those costs are covered within the Department of Science and Technology, because NICSO operates within the Department of Science and Technology. So we have decided that it is not justifiable at this point to establish a new body like the CSR or the National Search Foundation, but to establish NICSO rather like the National Intellectual Property Management Office, which operates at arm's length from the department, but uses the department's administrative machinery, so that we don't have to establish a whole new HR division, finance division, etc. So NICSO has been established as a so-called government component, and there are two or three different types of models that can be used to establish an office like NICMO, or in this case, NICSO, the National Indigenous Knowledge System Office, but to establish it within the department, but still working to some extent independently of the department. So we're engaging right now with Treasury in a structured process to identify what is the best form to give rise to NICSO, but within the department, so we're not establishing and incurring all the costs of establishing a new organization. So that's the way that this is unfolding. And we will obviously brief Parliament once we have completed the process with Treasury and Treasury has advised us on what they think is the best type of structure that NICSO should adopt. Coming now to Honourable Paulson's more specific question. Honourable Paulson, the knowledge field directorate that you refer to is in fact an executive directorate within the National Research Foundation, and it still exists there. In fact, it manages not only indigenous knowledge research activities, it also manages our marine and Arctic research program, our climate change research program, our earth system science. So essentially all of what is called the geographic advantage areas, as identified by the department, are managed within the knowledge field directorate. So it still exists, but not in the NRF, not in the DSD, it's an NRF body. And indeed, it does manage the IKS research programs. So it gets a grant from us, I think it's about 10 million rand or so a year, which it disperses to universities, mainly I think universities, who bid for research grants the way that they do for marine and Antarctic research or nanotechnology research or whatever. But in addition to that, honorable members, the department also has a number of other partners through whom IKS projects are rolled out, particularly at the sort of more commercial end, where there's already innovation and new products and services that are being commercialized or that are pre-development and so on. So there are a number of partners, direct relationships with universities. I think Pretoria University, for example, UKZN, Western Cape possibly. So there are direct relations between the DSC and certain stakeholders in addition to the program run by the National Research Foundation.
I think that is my contribution on this. I'll now hand over to the colleague.
Thank you, DG. Regarding the first question in terms of the IP Amendment Act and the bill, as I indicated in my preamble, that the IP Amendment Act is views IKS only from an economic perspective. The protection of IKS is very much more holistic and very comprehensive. If I have to make a parallel between the protection of IKS within the IP Amendment Act, is that if we look at our essentially there are four areas which our current intellectual property rights fails IKS. The first area in terms of protection, in terms of ownership, in terms of the criteria. So let's have a look at the first situation within your patents. Okay, within your patents you have four criteria. You have the criteria of novelty, you have the criteria of inventiveness, non-obviousness, and industrial application. So if you take the first criteria, novelty, given the nature of indigenous knowledge, that it comes from generation to generation, it's ancient. So it will fail the first criteria within your patents. Okay? If you take your copyright, the two criteria for copyright is it needs to be original and it must be in its material form. And if we go back to our criteria, indigenous knowledge transcends from generations to generations. So the original criteria is it will not satisfy the criteria of originality. So in terms of copyright, it will be incompatible to protect indigenous knowledge within the copyright field. Okay. In terms of protection, if you look at protecting a patent, the life of a patent is 20 years. Okay. Once the life of a patent expires, then that has to be in the public domain and it's free for use. If you go back to indigenous knowledge, it comes from generations to generations. So what has been held in secret over generations will then be exposed to a patent life of 20 years. Okay? So in terms of the secrecy and the sacredness, it will not satisfy the duration criteria. And lastly, in indigenous knowledge, by its very nature, it comes from generation to generation. It does not belong to the current generation. It is borrowed from the future generation. If you sell, if you pay an economic value to the knowledge in this generation, you bring that relationship to an end. Okay? So that is just in terms of why the IP Amendment Act will not sit within the IKS book. But more importantly, the IP Amendment Act affords ownership to a single author, to a single inventor. It does not provide ownership in terms of a collective or a communal nature. So that is essentially the fundamental difference why the IP Amendment Act would not suit the protection of IKS within our context. Okay?
If I may just quickly add something on the corner of my, I've explained this to myself by understanding that the philosophic and socio-economic purpose of the IP Amendment Bill, the IKS Bill, are completely different. And as a consequence of that, there are a number of legal technical differences that cannot be reconciled in one piece of legislation. And Mr. Sukananda has just given a number of examples in this respect.
The second question is, what is the bill protecting? If you look on the screen, this is what the bill is protecting. It's protecting the knowledge, okay? And, okay. So, try prior to the enactment of the GTI, the ID Amendment Act, this knowledge was free to use. Communities didn't accrue any benefits by that. Communities never accrued any benefits in terms of that. So in terms of the bill, these designs would be derivatives of the knowledge which the bill would be protecting. So anyone who wants to make these designs must enter into a benefit sharing agreement with the community that holds that knowledge. Okay. So in terms of what the bill is protecting, this is a diagrammatic presentation of what the bill is protecting. Then in terms of section 20 speech to address. Section 20 is also in compliance with our bioprospecting regulations. Our bioprospecting regulations are access and benefit sharing. So in terms of creating more formality, essentially no, because the process is already in place within the Department of Environmental Affairs. Environmental Affairs deals with access to genetic resources. The bill would deal with access to genetic resources associated with the knowledge. Okay. So, but more importantly, Section 20 gives effect to our ratification of the Dubai Protocol. So before it was an option, now it's an obligation on South Africa is to enact any legislation or any policies over in terms of access. So access, in terms of the bill, to me, is in the crux of the bill, because without access, then it's a free for all. Okay. In terms of legal procedure, no act can be applied retrospectively. However, the nature of IKA is retrospective. For example, I did indicate that it is knowledge which is protected from generation to generation. By change, it is retrospective. But the difference is when the act comes into place, any activities prior to that and which were completed will not be affected by the act. Any activities after the commencement of the act will be subjected to the sharing agreement to try and content. For example, if there was an act which occurred before the act but is now continuing after the act, will still be subjected to the act. So in terms of the law, there is no retroactive application of the act. It will be application from the time the act is in force and thereafter. Okay. In terms of who owns the IKA is owned by the community. The government.
But who establishes?
Sorry?
Who establishes the community? Like, say, for instance, there's a fight in the community, right? The two chiefs are fighting each other. Who owns that art of that community? And that can be a huge delay by not trading with the art and getting the benefit for the community.
Section 20 resolves that is the establishment of a mediation committee, and one of the main functions of this mediation committee is to resolve issues of ownership. So in terms of ownership, the resolution of who owns what will be resolved within the ambit of the mediation committee. In terms of the complexity, we do have the national record system, and within the national record system, we are already recording. We are already recording knowledge that resides in the community. So the national record system will be the the register to determine whose knowledge belongs to who.
Just to add to the last point which John was mentioning in terms of the national quarter system, it's a very structured system where the information of the community structure is being recorded and the community actually sits as part of the steering committee in terms of documentation. We also train the community members themselves to document, and the documentation only acts as a facilitator, as a custodian to all that information on behalf of the community.
Thank you. I'd like to just check if Ms. January wants to correct us on any of the legal issues.
No, you do. Charlie, can you talk?
I just like to get a sense of how does this knowledge then go from community onto this recording system? Do you capture it? And also, I didn't quite get that. Who has the most intellectual property on this knowledge that's captured?
Thank you, Honourable Member. In terms of how the information gets onto this particular system, the Department of Science and Technology established a documentation center in a particular province. This documentation center worked with the communities that have identified themselves as Community A, Community B. When we first go into a community, we sit with the chief and with his council to present this project to them. What are the benefits, what are the risks in terms of documenting your information and your knowledge. They put forward a steering committee that will work with the documentation center in identifying who are the knowledge practitioners in my community that have particular information on particular indigenous knowledge, whether it's healing, whether it's art, whether it's farming practices. Obviously, elders in the community know who's who and they know where people go to seek for help. So basically, after the steering committee and the elders who sit on that steering committee have identified the people, we task or ask the community through the chief and the board to appoint young people that we as the Department of Science and Technology and the CSR are trained on how to document, how to interview. We've structured and we developed structured interview systems, interview questionnaires and so forth. So basically, these young people are then asked to go to a specific person to catalog the person, what claims they have, and to record the full knowledge holding in multimedia format. That goes then back to the steering committee where the chief and the council are sitting to verify if this is the person that are part of my community, they're documented into the system. Further verification also takes part as at the end of the quarter where a documentation center facilitates a workshop or giving back to the community to say these are the people that we have documented and they are on the system. So basically there is a very structured way of getting the information in the system as well as the community giving permission for it because they do sign prior informed consent. We do have memorandum of understanding as well for the community in terms of keeping it within the legal framework and making sure the communities are happy and participate within the project.
In terms of who owns the intellectual property, so we need to make the distinction between intellectual property and intellectual property rights. Okay. So in terms of intellectual property, those that that record their information or their knowledge in the system are the holders of that intellectual property. In terms of intellectual property, when a researcher or a third party extract that information and get into a derivative in terms of a patent or a copyright, then it is under a legal framework in terms of patent sharing agreement and a material transfer agreement. So your material transfer agreement and your benefit sharing agreement will determine whether that holder of that intellectual property has also intellectual property rights. Okay? So within the material transfer agreement and the benefit sharing agreement, the holder of the community would then say, okay, I I would have only benefits, but in terms of the patent, you be the sole holder of the patent. Or alternatively, the company said we want to be joint holders. So that is a negotiated situation between the holder and the inventor. Okay. In terms of the negotiation protocol, which I've been talking all the time, demands that when communities and inventors negotiate, must be done within a biocultural protocol. So if that inventor or that researcher applies for a patent, and the patent officer sees that these conditions were not met, so a biocultural protocol was not adhered to, there was no prior informed consent, there were no benefits, that inventor will not be granted a patent. Thanks.
Systems of knowledge
of knowledge, systems of transferring knowledge about knowledge from one generation to another, integrating those systems with a system of legal structures and legal proceedings that emerged in parallel with one another, not jointly. And so there's an attempt to integrate these with one another and to try and structure the processes that would allow us to deal with complexities on one side using the instruments and techniques that have been developed on the other in the legal system. And there will be many opportunities for us to learn as we move ahead. As you said, we've got to start somewhere. This is the best start that we can think of. It's been informed also, I should point out, by extensive discussions about these sorts of things in lots of international fora. So my colleagues sit on the participating World Intellectual Property Office task teams and working groups and everything where these things are discussed there. So we really have drawn here on best practice globally in structuring the systems that we've put together. So we're confident that this is the best we could put together at the moment to try and manage potentially difficult issues.
No, I think let's appreciate the presentation from our high data committee agree that we have received it, we hear and understand where you come from. This is not a final thing, that this is what's going to happen. You are briefing us about the processes, the process that might not necessarily lead into this being presented to us as a product that is going ultimately to the legislature to be made into law. It might arrive there, it might not arrive there. The issues you are raising, why don't we just, instead of creating a new law, we just amend to make it possible for the committee or for this body to be established, or within what is there in the department to allow the section that is existing to continue to do its work without creating a legislation. It's possible it might end up being like that. But for now, we are grappling with how best we can deal with this matter, and this is what we are proposing from the side of the department. So we should allow you, DPG, to continue with the interaction, because even in your presentation, though you didn't talk to, you indicated that it must go to the executive, it must go to CLASAR, it must still go to cabinet, and then there you did not even put a date. What date is, yeah. You didn't put a date because you don't know when it will go there, it might be next year. But you are determined to get it done probably by the end of this year, so we should be comfortable with the processes you are unfolding, and wish you well as far as that's concerned. And I think by the time it comes to us, we will also have done some work and have a better understanding on how to process it further until it becomes law. But thanks very much for the presentation. The committee received well. They've asked the questions that they wanted to. And they will continue to go through this and do their own research when it comes. You might find that we are experts on this. We can engage with you at that level. But thanks very much, DDG, and your team. It was a good interacting with you on the processes around the deal. Thank you very much, and thanks to members who might allow us to wait a bit. There might be some things we must exchange views on for 5-10 minutes. But yeah, you are late. I'm sorry if we just assume that you took something to drink since you arrived here. We never offered you. But thank you. You can grab something on your way out. Thank you very much. But we're told that you have something to do, but you're going as well.
Thanks, Jay. For the moment, yes, Jay. Yeah, I'm
go to Connecticut to speak, but I'm doing. I'm not going to bore you.
September. I know I and the chairman, who's in absence now, are away that week. So if the committee can just hear that in mind. I think it's a committee week for Parliament in any area, on with the party system. I just. You
know.
Okay.